The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. I'm Judge Greenberg. With me are Judges Meredith and Toth. We're convened via teleconference to hear arguments in the matter of Joan Nalos versus the Secretary. Will counsel, beginning with counsel for the appellant, please enter your appearances.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Chris Attig representing the appellant, Joan Nalos.
Counsel for the Secretary.
Good morning. This is Mark Vichich. I am arguing on behalf of the Secretary today. I'm accompanied today by Sarah Fusino.
Seems to be a bit of a issue there. Mr. Block, did you see that?
Sir, I did. And Mr. Vichich, if you could you take yourself off mute and one more time introduce yourself and co-counsel for our record? You were garbled.
This is Mark Vichich. I am here on behalf of the Secretary today, and I am accompanied today by Sarah Fusina.
All right. Does appellant's counsel wish to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Very good. All right, let's proceed. Mr. Attig.
May it please the court. Mrs. Nalos is the 94-year-old surviving spouse of a deceased veteran who survived the attack on Pearl Harbor. Today, she asked the court to address an issue of first impression, the meaning of the exception to the aid and attendance effective date rule in 38 CFR 3.402C1. The party's dispute over this exception and its meaning is very narrow. For example, the parties agree that 3.402C1 establishes aid and attendance effective date as the later of the date of the claim for aid and attendance or the date the entitlement arose. The parties agree that 3.402C1 contains an exception to that general rule. The parties agree on what triggers that exception. An award of DIC is effective before receipt of the aid and attendance claim. In fact, the Secretary says that there is no reasonable alternative interpretation. And the parties agree on what the exception is. When it applies, the date the entitlement to aid and attendance arose is the effective date for aid and attendance. Excuse me. The parties disagree about one, excuse me. The parties disagree about one thing. The Secretary wants the court to limit the exception in 3.402C1 to only those scenarios where aid and attendance is raised during the pendency of the DIC claim. In other words, the Secretary wants this court to hold that the exception in 3.402C1 does not apply unless the DIC claim is still in the process of being adjudicated when the aid and attendance claim is raised.
Well, what's the basis for that?
The basis—
There is no basis for it, I assume you're going to— Answer.
Appellant does not see any legal basis for that argument, Your Honor. And that's two reasons we believe that the court can't give the Secretary what he wants. The first is that the regulation's text and its purpose don't support that interpretation. But to get to the benefit of the exception, the aid and attendance must be raised while DIC is being adjudicated. There's nothing in the text of the regulation that says that. There's nothing in the preamble to the regulation that says that. The Secretary seems to be relying on a single phrase from the proposed regulation or the preamble to the proposed regulation that says, we propose that 3.402C specifically provide that either aid and attendance or housebound benefit may also be awarded retroactively in conjunction with a retroactive award of pension, compensation, or DIC. They're putting a lot of weight into that phrase in conjunction with, and it does not support that interpretation. First, if the Secretary had meant for that phrase to be important, he would have used it, exactly that phrase, in the regulation. And second, that's not what in conjunction with necessarily means. For example, today, somewhere in the country, a book's author is going on tour in conjunction with the publication of their recent book. The publication has already happened. In conjunction with does not mean simultaneously.
So Mr. Attig, I don't want to interrupt you. I want to hear the second reason, but let me ask you this. I mean, you know, first I want to commend you for, you know, taking up the answering the call and representing Ms. Nalos, and then for the quality of your briefing. I mean, you brought some good arguments. I mean, what I'm struggling with is the for any part language, right? I mean, I think everything you say squares with a plausible reading, except for that, right? And how do you account for, like, how would you account for that phrase in the role within the reg overall?
Your Honor, Ms. Nalos sees that particular phrase, and the phrase falls in the what we call in the brief the independent clause, or the actual substance of the exception. And that phrase says that essentially that additional DIC for aid and attendance shall also be awarded for any part of the award's retroactive period.
Well, I mean, because to me, there's kind of two ways you could read that, just that particular phrase. One is, it implies a sort of relation to another thing, right? Which I think is sort of the Secretary's argument. It implies a conjunction to another claim for which there's retroactive benefits. The other would be, it's just sort of extraneous, right? I mean, it's kind of repetitive. You would be entitled to part of the award to which you were entitled, right? I mean, I think that's, under your reading, it just becomes sort of useless language. Am I understanding that correctly?
I don't see it as useless language, Your Honor. I see that reading that entire section as a whole and looking back to what triggers the exception is talking for any part of that award's retroactive period. And regardless of whether the court agrees that the award's retroactive period refers to aid and attendance or DIC, it's talking about a retroactive period. And that retroactive period is going to be the part behind the time when the claim was granted. So if in fact the secretary wanted to limit it to the retroactive period as it was determined in the processing of the DIC claim, it would have said that specifically. And I think that in conjunction, when you add the for any part of the award's retroactive period, and you couple that with the reference to the original or supplemental claim in the exception, I think what the secretary or the drafter is communicating is that this is a broad exception, that applies, and it doesn't matter if the appellant is seeking DIC through a reopened claim under legacy, through a supplemental claim under AMA, or in their original claim, whether it happened within 1 year of the death or years after the death. I think that those two pieces work together to suggest a very broad reading of this regulation. And in fact, the secretary suggests in their briefs that our proposed interpretation swallows the general rule. And I would disagree with that and provide that there are two scenarios where that general rule would remain in effect. The first is where aid and attendance entitlement arises after the aid and attendance claim is filed. The second is where the aid and attendance entitlement arises before the DIC claim is filed. So looking at the first, if a survivor is currently receiving DIC, whether it's just been granted or it was granted 10 years ago, if they file an aid and attendance claim, the exception is triggered. However, if the survivor cannot establish that the aid and attendance entitlement did not arise until after the claim was filed, the general effective date rule is still going to apply. And the second scenario is when aid and attendance entitlement arises before the DIC claim.
And so, I mean, is it your contention that sort of ties to the specific nature of an aid and attendance claim? Because, I mean, normally it would be a little bit absurd to sort of have, you know, the entitlement for which you're applying kind of arise after you've applied, right? Because that's, I mean, you're applying for it, you don't necessarily qualify for it at that time. But I mean, maybe in attendance, because a lot of times with elderly people that they may not quite yet qualify for it, but I think it's contemplated that, you know, they'll, you know, with a year or two later, they may be entitled. Is that sort of the reasoning behind that?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with the premise. I think that, and I can only speak anecdotally to this, I don't have any record evidence, but I can speak to the lay understanding of the aid and attendance regulations is much broader, I think, than the actual regulation itself. And so I can speak anecdotally to cases where I have seen individuals, veterans and survivors, claim aid and attendance, yet not be able to establish that entitlement. And so I think that happens again, speaking anecdotally and outside the record, I think that happens fairly frequently. So I don't know that I agree with the premise that necessarily that would be, those would be unusual circumstances, but they both go to the point that our proposed interpretation does not swallow or eviscerate the general effective date rule, that there are still scenarios where that would apply. And I think the second reason, kind of going back to my original point, that there's two reasons why the court cannot give the secretary the relief he's seeking. The second reason is that even if the court agrees with the secretary and says that aid and attendance entitlement or effective date is determined by when the entitlement arose during the pendency of the DIC claim, Ms. Nalos would win under that argument. She filed a claim to reopen her DIC in November of 2009, and that claim was not finally adjudicated until this court issued its mandatory in clause number 17-1065 in September of 2019. So during the pendency of that dependency indemnity compensation claim in May 30th of 2017, she raised the entitlement to aid and attendance. So even if the court adopts the secretary's interpretation, the facts of this case still drive the outcome for in Ms. Nalos' favor, that the court should award that aid and attendance if the court believes our argument or accepts our argument that there's no permissible view of the evidence other than the fact that she was entitled to aid and attendance as of the date of her injury in June 2nd of 2015.
Could I jump in there? I do have some specific questions for you about the particulars of the language in the regulation, but I want to start with sort of a more general question. It seems to me that under your reading of C1, an appellant may be entitled to a retroactive award of aid and attendance that is greater than 1 year prior to the date of the claim. I believe here you're asking for 2015-ish based on a 2017 claim. So when C1 was promulgated, VA noted that DIC at that time could already be, and pension and compensation could already be awarded retroactively in certain circumstances, and pointed to two specific examples in 3.400B1 and C2 that both contain a 1 year retroactive period, meaning you can get benefits for up to 1 year prior to the date of the claim for those benefits. And so given that reference to these 1 year periods in the Federal Register, how would you square it if under your reading of the regulation, more than a 1 year period could be allowed retroactively for aid and attendance? How do you square it with those references?
Your Honor, I square that assessment that in the preamble to the regulation itself, that the Secretary did mention those. I think they spoke to two scenarios where the effective date for DIC could precede the date of claim. The first was 3.400B1. And in that was the example of where an individual is entitled to a special monthly pension, then the effective date, and I believe I don't want to speak out of turn here, I would need to check this and come back to the court if that would be appropriate. But I believe that there's a statute that controls that particular regulation that says that in the event of special monthly pension, the effective date for that award is either whichever benefits the appellant greater, which is the one within the date that they became permanently and totally disabled, as long as they filed a claim within 1 year. And the second exception is 3.400C2. And that exception does derive directly from a statute. And the statute 5110D is the statute that says that so long as a survivor files a claim within 1 year of the veteran's death, that the effective date will be the date of death. And I think that both of those, aside from the fact that they both derive from a statutory authority, I think that what they speak to is something broader, and that first of all, is that Congress's desire is that the benefit goes to the survivor, or in the case of the other regulations that aren't here, 3.400 and 3.404 goes to the veteran. But specifically, the benefit of the effective date should go to the survivor. And the second piece is that what's driving the analysis, and the secretary concedes this in the preamble to his regulation, what drives the analysis is the date the entitlement arose for the aid in attendance. So those are the two ways that I would distinguish that, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this way. So the purpose of C1 was essentially to create some amount of parity, because DIC compensation pension could already be awarded retroactively in certain circumstances, and VA was trying to create a similar retroactive provision for aid in attendance. So would it be consistent? In fact, the language that they use in the Federal Register was that aid in attendance may also be awarded retroactively. So is it consistent with that purpose to then allow aid in attendance to be awarded for a longer retroactive period than was already in effect for DIC compensation pension, the benefits with which it was trying to create a parity?
Your Honor, I think that the where I would respectfully disagree is that aid in attendance is part of DIC. It's an additional component of it. It's an enhancement of DIC. And so if the effective date rules for aid in attendance are going to have parity, they're going to have parity with the DIC rules, if that exists. And that our interpretation does not foreclose that possibility. In fact, there's no scenario under our interpretation where the effective date for aid in attendance could precede the date of the DIC claim.
And it's the 1 year period that I'm questioning is in 3010, I believe you referenced already, and 3.400 that were in effect then. There were a number of different, as you pointed out, retroactive provisions for effective dates, but generally they were limited to the one year prior to the date of the claim. So I'm wondering how your, if we were to interpret C1 the way you're asking us to, would it be consistent with the overall structure of the effective date provisions that were in effect at the time it was promulgated?
I do believe it would be consistent, Your Honor, because aid in attendance attaches to the DIC claim. And so those regulations brought the aid in attendance effective dates, which did not exist at the time when these regulations were published. There was no indication that aid in attendance could in any way be retroactive at all. And so this was bringing the aid in attendance effective date rules in line with the DIC effective date rules, which said that you can get that benefit up to the date of death if you file the claim within 1 year. That's essentially the scenario we're looking at there. And so that happens here as well, as it brings the aid in attendance in line with DIC rather than bringing aid in attendance in line with some general effective date concept that came out in 3010. Overall. So I think, and that what drives that is that aid in attendance is an enhancement of DIC. It's part and parcel of DIC. It's essentially the same thing, a larger benefit for a greater need.
If I could, as I mentioned, I do have a couple of questions for you about the specific language of C1. And you started out by mentioning that you and the Secretary are in agreement that in the however sentence, the phrase, the date of receipt of the claim refers to the aid in attendance claim. And I would just read that part of the regulation, and it starts out with, when an award of DIC based on an original or reopened claim is effective for a period prior to the date of receipt of the claim. So after that portion of the sentence specifically mentions a DIC claim, why would we then read the second reference to claim, to the claim, as meaning something other than the DIC claim that was just referenced in that portion of the sentence?
Your Honor, I would refer to our briefs for the detailed analysis, but what we're saying is that just in terms of looking at the grammatical structure of that dependent clause, which is essentially defining when something happens, it would not create a logical result if the court was to read the second appearance of date of receipt of claim to mean the DIC claim, because it would only speak to one particular scenario that, as we explain in the brief, would only benefit those survivors who are savvy enough to foresee that if they file their DIC claim within 1 year of the date of death, that really is going to have a great advantage to them 10, 15 years down the road if they file an aid in attendance claim. I don't think that Congress ever intended, or I don't truly believe that the drafter of this regulation intended that narrow or precise of an interpretation. But I would defer to our grammatical interpretation in the briefs for why we think date of receipt of claim refers back.
The intention of the drafters in the Federal Register, in explaining the need for this provision, VA talked about how DIC could already be awarded retroactively and that there wasn't a similar provision for aid in attendance, and noted that claims for DIC may be effective for periods prior to the date the claim is filed. Do you believe that that reference to the date the claim is filed refers to the DIC claim? And if so, then why we read it different when VA then mirrored that exact language or close to it in the actual regulation, that it would mean something other than the date of the DIC claim?
Your Honor, may I pull up just that particular publication just to look closely at that language to make sure I'm reading it correctly?
Yes. I'll ask the clerk to add about 5 minutes, please.
Your Honor, I don't know that I can speak to what the drafter in the preamble is referring to. I don't know that necessarily that. I think that the court could look at the language of the regulation and make the deduction of what the drafter is trying to do, and the specific reference to that. I don't know that I can make that assessment as to which they're referring to. I don't know. It's the when I first read this regulation in the course of doing this case, it was a very confusing looking regulation, and at this point, it's become clear to me that it looks a certain way. And so I haven't focused on what the drafter might have meant in the preamble with the use of a particular phrase. But I would direct the court to our analysis of the grammatical structure of that clause to be able to say that whatever the drafter put in the preamble, what they put in the regulation, I believe is grammatically clear, and that it refers back to the second use of date of receipt of claim refers back to the aid and attendance of claim. It's the only way from Ms. Nalo's perspective that the clause as a whole makes sense. I believe that I have run into my rebuttal time.
No, keep going.
If I could, I just have one more. I'd like to ask you about the second part of the however sentence. And you talked a little bit earlier with Judge Toth about this in the last part, where you have argued that the phrase "the awards retroactive period" refers to the aid and attendance award. And so if you read it that way, as you argued in your reply brief, it would say that any additional DIC payable by reason of need for aid and attendance shall also be awarded for any part of the aid and attendance awards retroactive period. I know you already talked a little bit with Judge Toth about this, but I'm wondering if you could just explain to us, what does that mean? Is it redundant to say that aid and attendance will also be awarded for the period of the aid and attendance awards retroactive period? If you're already awarding aid and attendance retroactively, what else is there to also award?
In our briefs, we argued that that second use of the award refers to the aid and attendance award. And Ms. Nalo stands behind that argument. In preparing for oral argument, though, the thought occurred to me that regardless of how the court interprets that phrase, aid and attendance or DIC, if it's referring to the aid and attendance award or the DIC award, the result will still be the same. The result will still be that the driving concern for the driving focus for the effective date for aid and attendance, when the exception is triggered, is the date the entitlement to aid and attendance arose. That's really what this regulation is driving at. And so regardless of how the court was to read that phrase, it still does not change the fact that the aid and attendance entitlement arising date is the date that controls.
In this case, if we read it that way, part of the DIC awards retroactive period, what retroactive DIC period is there in this case?
The retroactive DIC period is the period prior to the claim date for the DIC. So I'm sorry, I spoke out of turn. The retroactive date for that is the period prior to the grant of DIC. So when the VA granted DIC, they awarded retroactive DIC back to November of 2009.
The fact that retroactive in a different sense than what we just talked about in the statute, where the retroactive periods are generally for periods prior to the date of the claim, you're using retroactively to mean from claim date to decision date?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I apologize if that is I must have miscommunicated. I apologize. What I'm trying to say is that when the award was granted, it was granted retroactive to the date of the claim. That's the retroactive award. At least in terms of how I understand the word retroactive to mean, is that the secretary at the time they granted DIC had a decision as to what date to choose. They could have chosen the date the date that they made the decision to award aid in attendance, in which case nothing would have been retroactive. But that essentially is how we see that retroactive period is the period of time prior to the award of DIC. If there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Fine. Anything further, Judge Toth?
I just had one question. And again, this won't cut into your rebuttal time, but I mean, you covered a little bit of this, but I want to kind of be as explicit as possible and sort of pinning it down about the relationship between an ANA claim and a DIC claim, you know, the extent to which they're kind of fundamentally distinct or this, you said part and parcel. So, I mean, I think it's clear that when an ANA claim is sort of, when a person has DIC already and an ANA claim is brought later in time as a sort of, it's viewed as kind of a separate claim for sort of an increased rating, somewhat like TDIU, I guess. What about when they're brought together, right? When somebody files, how, like, do they have to actually physically, you know, file a form for ANA, or do they just have to sort of plead a certain facts? How are those two, the DIC and the ANA claim, are they viewed as distinct or the same? Can you speak to that?
I've seen several ways, Your Honor, where in terms of how the aid in attendance is raised. I've seen scenarios where the claim for aid in attendance is filed on a form alongside the claim for DIC. I've seen situations where in this particular case, the aid in attendance was triggered by an intent to file aid in attendance that was filed on May 30th. I think that there are cases following from Akles v. Derwinski where you could argue that the aid in attendance is reasonably raised during the course of a DIC claim. I think those are all scenarios where it could be raised. And our interpretation doesn't conflict with any of those scenarios. So in any of those scenarios, the situation would still be the same, is that if the exception is triggered and it's triggered by an award of DIC being in effect prior to the date of the receipt of the aid in attendance claim, that's the trigger. And that doesn't change based on when or how an appellant raises the entitlement to aid in attendance.
Anything else, Judge Meredith, at this point, or Judge Toth?
Not at this point, thank you.
No, I'm good, right. Thanks.
We'll hear from the government. Counsel?
Hello again, this is Mark Vitch. I am appearing on behalf of the Secretary today. The board here properly found that May 30th, 2017 was the earliest date on which appellant filed her claim for aid and attendance benefits. In November 2009, when she filed an application for DIC benefits, she informed VA in box 31 of that form that she was not seeking an aid and attendance allowance at that time. She did not inform VA that she was seeking aid and attendance benefits until June 2017, which is, she submitted evidence in support of her May 2017 claim. The date of claim for the aid and attendance benefit, parties agree, is therefore May 30th, 2017. Under the first sentence of section 3.402(c)(1), the effective date was properly tied to the date of claim for that benefit. Much of the briefing in this case is focused around the language in the second sentence in section 3.402(c)(1), which provides an exception to the first. That language, that sentence, does not apply for three reasons. Number one, reading the sentence in its entirety confirms that it potentially applies only where DIC has been awarded before the period that benefit has been claimed, before the date of claim for DIC. Number two, interpreting the regulation as applying to this situation here would require the secretary to award an effective date not authorized by statute. And third, the secretary's discussion in the Federal Register in 1980 when he added this language confirms that he had a narrow situation in mind, and that situation is not present here. So I'm going to start directly with the language, because based on what Helen argued in opening argument here, it appears the parties disagree on the term retroactive period. The secretary interprets the term retroactive period in the sentence to be the period before the date the DIC claim is filed. The second term that is relevant to understanding the meaning is the word shall also. The term shall also means that the aid in attendance award would be awarded in conjunction with the underlying DIC claim.
Sorry to slow you down, but in terms of the also question, kind of triggers my last question to Mr. Attic about, I mean, what's the relationship necessarily between a DIC claim and an ANA claim? I mean, are they fundamentally distinct? Are they the same? Is it conditional on the kind of situation? Do you have a position on that?
Well, yeah, it depends. And I think the kind of the clue, the answer is kind of maybe a missing piece of this puzzle is section 38 CFR section 3.10A and E, which says that when VA grants DIC benefits, it will determine the appropriate rate. And the appropriate rate will be, at the very minimum, the basic rate and any enhancements, for example, the aid in attendance enhancement. And that's the fact situation contemplated by this exception. DIC is claimed, aid in attendance is raised, whether it's a separate claim or part of that claim, it's raised at the same time, and they are awarded together. And then this exception, this regulation discusses, well, what happens if DIC is awarded before the date of claim, for example, under 5110D, can the aid in attendance benefit also go back before the date of claim? And the answer is yes, it can. Both can go back before the date of claim. But then what's tricky about this case is that we don't have those facts here. We have a separate claim, aid in attendance claim, that was not raised until years later in 2017. So again, the box 31 of the DIC form, which in this case is found at page 1739 of the record, solicits this information from a claimant saying, are you seeking aid in attendance benefits as well? So that's where aid in attendance could be raised as part of a DIC claim. But here it wasn't raised as part of the DIC claim, it was raised as a separate claim. And that's why this case doesn't get past the first sentence of section 3.402C1. It's a simple case. All we have to determine is what's the date of claim, what's the date entitlement arose. In this case, the parties agreed May 30th, 2017 is the date of claim. We only get into this exception if we have a retroactive period, that is a period before the DIC claim was filed, where the DIC is awarded retroactively. And that's where the parties disagree. And the secretary's position is that retroactive period is the period before the date of claim. For example, if DIC is awarded under 5110D based on receiving the DIC application within 1 year of death. And in fact, adopting appellant's interpretation would require the secretary to award benefits more than 1 year before the date of the May 30th, 2017 claim. But as Judge Meredith's question raised, the issue is there's no, secretary doesn't have authority to award benefits more than a year before the date of claim. And that's why the appellant's interpretation of this exception is not consistent with the statutory theme. The secretary would also point to the Federal Register example, which again describes that the fact situation that is completely different from this case. And in that case, the pension was awarded before the date of claim, and aid in attendance was raised as part of that claim, and both went back before the date of claim. But here we just don't have that situation.
Go ahead, continue.
A lot of this case is focused on the issue of judicial deference. The secretary just wants to clarify, or at least emphasize some points here. Is he's not asking the court to jump to the question of deference. He's asking the court to adopt his interpretation of the regulation based on reading the entire sentence, looking at the history of this regulation and looking at its placement within how it's in 5110, that is this, because the secretary's regulation, because the secretary's interpretation is consistent with 5110, that's the better interpretation. So we're just asking the court to adopt our interpretation because it's the better interpretation. Judicial deference is raised only if the court finds that the regulation is genuinely ambiguous after exhausting all of the tools of regulatory construction. And but if the court needs to ask whether deference is warranted, the secretary does ask the court to defer to his interpretation because it's consistent with how he described this regulation 41 years ago when he published notice of it in the Federal Register, and he has not taken any contrary positions. There's Secretary has not offered any conflicting interpretations, at least none that I have found or that appellant has located. So we ask that deference is warranted if the court needs to ask for deference. The secretary doesn't have any other points to make. The secretary did want to just make a point about the reversal argument. If the court disagrees with the secretary's interpretation, remand, not reversal, would be the appropriate remedy because the court has not made any factual findings as to when entitlement to this benefit arose. So we would ask that the court, in the alternative, remand this case rather than reverse. But we are asking the court to affirm the board's decision because the board's interpretation of the regulation is consistent with the interpretation the secretary offers today, and that May 30th, 2017 is the earliest date the secretary can legally award aid and attendance benefits in this case.
Judge Meredith, any questions?
Yes, thank you. I want to follow up with you about a conversation I had with appellant's counsel regarding the first part of the however sentence and what date of receipt of claim means. In your opening brief, the secretary suggested that means the aid in attendance claim. But as I discussed with appellant's counsel, that part of the sentence starts out when an award of DIC based on an original reopened claim is effective for a period prior to the date of receipt of the claim. So could we or should we read the claim to be referring to what was just mentioned in the prior part of the sentence, meaning the DIC claim that is effective prior to the award of the DIC claim? Or I'm sorry, the DIC is the claim that's being referred to in that part of the sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the difficulty here is that we're looking at language that just was not meant to apply to the facts of this case. So the claim here is assuming that aid in attendance would be raised with the DIC claim. There would be a single claim that included aid in attendance. So I think that's consistent with Section 3.10E, which is how these are typically, how aid in attendance, well, I wouldn't say how typically raised, but how VA treats aid in attendance as a component of a DIC claim, which is supported by the application form, the DIC application form in box 31, which specifically asks the person to give us the information the VA would need to know whether this entitlement is warranted. So I think, like, what is the meaning of claim? And it really depends. It depends here because the claim could mean DIC with an aid in attendance claim, or it could be a separate claim. But I think I think probably the best, the easiest answer to this sort of interpretive conundrum is just to look no further than the first sentence, date of receipt of claim or date of entitlement arose. And we're talking here about aid in attendance. So what, getting to that second sentence, it doesn't apply. It doesn't even apply because we don't have a retroactive DIC award. We don't have this aid in attendance granted with the DIC claim. So we just don't get to the second sentence here. But as far as the reference to the award's retroactive period, that is referring to the DIC or pension award referred to earlier in the sentence. Your Honor, I just wanted to make one point about the use of the definite and indefinite article. Appellant argues that, well, the secretary referred to an award earlier in the sentence and then the award in later in the sentence. So that means he's referring to two different awards. The secretary disagrees with that interpretation. Probably the best sort of illustration I could have for that is if I were to say the court is going to hold an oral argument today, the oral argument is at 10, you would know that I was talking about the same oral argument just because I used an when referring to the oral argument first, and then I used the when referring to the oral argument the next time. You wouldn't think that I was referring to a different oral argument. And that's essentially what the appellant is arguing here when he's saying, well, you refer to an award up there, but then the award here for the retroactive period, you obviously were talking about a different retroactive award. And that's not really a plausible interpretation, because the retroactive award period here necessarily refers to the DIC award. There's no other award that it could be referring to. And I think one of Judge Toth's questions raised this is how can you talk about an award that's already awarded? It just doesn't make sense. So if we are talking about a retroactive DIC award, which means the period before the DIC claim where DIC is awarded, can aid in attendance go back to that retroactive period? And the answer is yes, it can.
Judge Meredith, anything further?
No, I don't have anything further. Thank you.
Judge Toth?
No, thank you.
All right, counsel, you can proceed if you've got further argument.
I do not have any other points to make. We just asked the court to adopt his interpretation of the regulation. It's the most plausible interpretation. We're not asking for deference unless the court determines that the regulation is ambiguous, in which case we do ask the court to defer to his interpretation. And we just ask the court to affirm the court's decision. And that's all we have today. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks very much. All right, Mr. Attig, we'll hear from you in rebuttal. By the way, before you begin, I really should have asked this earlier. You made reference to a statute but you hadn't at your fingertips the citation. Have you had a chance to look at your record with regard to that statute? If not, I would ask you to promptly at the conclusion of the argument, email the court, just a reference to the statute you were referring to earlier in your argument.
Yes, Ron, I did not locate that during counsel's response arguments.
So. Well, I must tell you, actually, I said email. I don't know how you communicated it except to send it to the clerk's office, obviously, and the clerk will get it to the judges. But I happen to view this as fundamentally a matter of statutory construction and the intent of Congress when dealing with combat veterans and their survivors. So it might be valuable for you to give us the benefit of that statute. Anyway, make your argument, please.
Yes, Your Honor, there's just a couple of points that I would like to respond to. The Secretary made reference to what Ms. Nalos put as a checkbox in a form in November 2009 regarding whether or not she was requesting aid in attendance. I'm not sure I see the materiality of that fact, because it's not disputed that she was claiming it at any time in November of 2009. In fact, the earliest that the entitlement arose was her injury on the job in June of 2015. So I'm not too sure what a check block in a form 6 years prior to that would necessarily tell the court about how to interpret this regulation. The second thing is in terms of—
Well, actually, why would a person who didn't have the need for this benefit check the box until they had the need? I mean, isn't that dissembling or confusing, or is it really accurate for the secretary to claim you've got to check the box for something that might happen in the future but wasn't present at the time you were filling out the form?
Certainly, I think if from looking at the form, just from the perspective of a potential claimant, I would see that as an opportunity to raise aid in attendance at the same time as I'm raising my claim for DIC. But I think that failing to check that doesn't necessarily speak to whether or not it's being claimed at the time of DIC either, because I think that there is a misunderstanding about what aid in attendance is. I think it's a confusing benefit, and I think it means something very different in its lay terminology than the precise regulatory definition that controls it. And that may not be something that 80, 85, 90-year-old surviving spouses may have the wherewithal to understand, particularly when they're filing these claims pro se in one of the most traumatic periods of their life, the loss of their spouse. So I don't know that that particular check block could inform anything. But what we do know in this case is that we have a survivor that was entitled, did need aid in attendance as early as June 2015. There's testimony in the board hearing from Ms. Nalos' son saying that she moved in because she needed that help in June 2015. And she said in her own VA Form 9 that she needed that, I forgot what her exact phrase was, help at home or house help or something to that effect in her VA Form 9 as early as June of 2015. So we know that that need arose. And
so that's sorry to interrupt, but that's where your argument is. She already meets the requirements as interpreted by the secretary.
Yes, at that time, yes. And that's one of the reasons that going to my second point that I wanted to respond to was why we seek reversal. If the court accepts our interpretation is because regardless of what findings of fact the board did or did not make or could not have made, they had an opportunity to make a finding of fact or an opportunity to state that she was not entitled to DIC. The fact that they didn't do that doesn't change the fact that the only permissible view of the evidence in the record is that as of June 2015, Ms. Nalos needed the aid and attendance of another to get through basic daily living activities, whether it's taking her medication, whether it's navigating her house, or whether it's climbing up one single step to get onto an exam table at the doctor's office.
Go ahead. You have further argument?
Well, at this time, we would just ask the court to interpret 3.402C1 to find that when DIC is in effect before the date of the aid and attendance claim, irrespective of when the DIC is adjudicated, the effective date is the date of the entitlement to aid and attendance and when that arose.
And you believe that that argument is more consistent with the clear intent of Congress when it comes to, broadly speaking, the benefits to combat veterans and their survivors?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that it's not only consistent with Congress, but it's consistent with the Secretary's own belief structure. We routinely hear and drives back to President Lincoln's comment that the purpose of these benefits are to assist the veteran and those who bore the battle, and that includes the survivors. And I think that what we're trying to create is a system that isn't full of traps and riddles that have to be navigated, that it should be straightforward and clean. And frankly, it would have been nice in a fact scenario like this that the VA would have said, hey, we see that you're entitled to aid and attendance. That entitlement is clear. We're going to go ahead and consider that without requiring you to fill out a particular form. That may not necessarily be at issue in this particular case, however. But I do agree that it's Congress's desire to see a very straightforward, simple system, not just for the veterans, but for the survivors who probably have even less familiarity with this system than the veterans themselves. If the court agrees with our interpretation, we would ask them to find that the only permissible view of the evidence is that Ms. Nalos' entitlement to aid and attendance arose June 2nd, 2015. If the court believes that more fact-finding is necessary to determine the date the entitlement arose, to remand to the board for expeditious adjudication of that fact for Ms. Nalos.
Well, why? She's 94, and this case has been going on a long time. You content with a remand? What is the board going to do on a remand, assuming the court sees it that way, as opposed to a flat out reversal, and we enter judgment in accordance with your request? By the way, what judgment would you ask the court to enter, assuming it agreed with the arguments you made?
The judgment I would ask the court to enter is, first of all, the interpretation of 3.402, and then the reversal and the grant of the benefit. I agree that the board would not have anything to do but to find that June 2015 is the date the entitlement arose. The facts don't support any other view of that and from our perspective. So I'm only asking for a remand as an alternative remedy out of an abundance of caution. But I do believe that reversal is the appropriate remedy. And I would ask the court, in terms of the specific judgment, I would ask the court to find that 3.402C1 states that when DIC is in effect before the date of the aid and attendance claim, irrespective of when DIC is actually adjudicated, the effective date is the date the entitlement to aid and attendance arose. And then I would ask the court to reverse the board's decision and grant entitlement to aid and attendance in June 2nd, 2015.
Thank you. Judge Meredith, any questions?
No, thank you.
Judge Toth?
You know, I don't have a question, but I have a brief comment, if you'll indulge me. You know, like everyone, I've been on a lot of Zoom meetings in the last year. And Mr. Attig, you have by far the best background I have seen with your, you should be proud of the array of books you have. It's even better than Judge Greenberg's background. So, but nothing else, thanks.
Yeah, but the difference is I've read all those books. So whatever they are those real books, Mr. Attig?
No, Your Honor, unfortunately, they're
there you go, sorry. But you, I'd like to commend both counsel for their arguments made in their briefs and today. And it's clear that both counsel are excellent lawyers and didn't need the contents of the books, real or otherwise. You've got a command of the law and the facts of this case, and we, the court, appreciate it. So with that, we will consider the case submitted.
And the court.